The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. All of a sudden, Europe's voters are rejecting austerity at the ballot box. So what happens now? François Hollande is France's first socialist president in a generation, and he won with promises to soak the rich and tear up the EU's Pact of Pain. Meanwhile, in Athens, chaos reigns as the Greek general election fails to provide any sort of government. Has Europe's plan to cut its way out of crisis now reached democratic limits? Also this week, after a pounding in the polls, the coalition has announced the latest priorities for the government. But with economic sirens sounding every week, will any of it help to get the economy off of the rocks? Joining me to discuss all of this, we have The Guardian columnists Martin Kettle and Aditya Chakraborty, as well as The New Statesman's Raphael Baer. And on the line from Paris, we have our correspondent Angelique Christophis. A warm welcome to you all. The European Union's plan to avoid its currency disappearing down the plug hole is stark. Countries must cut their debts, and quickly, even if that means savagely cutting the living standards of the people. This week, though, voters in France and in Greece emphatically turn their thumbs down at the idea, and Nicolas Sarkozy becomes the ninth European leader to be shown the door in just over a year. Raph, it's a tricky business, isn't it, governing in Europe today? General de Gaulle once said France was ungovernable, but is Europe as a whole now?
Well, it's certainly looking very tricky for incumbents everywhere, because naturally when the sort of the economy tanks along the bottom for a long period of time, there's a sense of crisis. Whoever happens to be the government is going to get a kicking. I think there are two different components to this that it's important to tease out. One is a sort of institutional crisis, which is that problems have been rumbling along in the Eurozone for quite a long time, and all the measures that have been taken, the fiscal stability pact, the everything that they've tried to do at sort of Brussels level simply hasn't worked to address market concerns. And then completely separate to that, there's the sort of street level response, which is people thinking, well, we are feeling personal pain from whether it's wages being cut or jobs, public sector jobs going, and that, you know, we are therefore the being punished for something that we do not see ourselves as the perpetrators of. And when you combine those two things, yes, you do, it looks like a sort of epic political crisis.
So the streets and the markets pulling in completely different directions. And Angelique, before he was elected, François Hollande sounded like he was more interested in the street. Has that changed now that he's got the job?
Well, I think one thing you have to remember about Hollande is that he's not, he's been portrayed as, understood perhaps abroad as this kind of dangerous tax and spend socialist, which he's not at all. He's quite a moderate centrist. And I think we're going to see when he meets Merkel next week exactly how far down the line he's going to go on austerity. In France, the austerity vote, if we can call it that, was very interesting. It wasn't so much a vote on austerity. It was really a vote on anti-Sarkozy and his whole being persona and failure to stop the unemployment crisis, for example, rather than this idea that France is being cut to shreds, because, of course, France has not yet been cut to shreds. In France, they've always gone for tax rises over public spending cuts, and Sarkozy started cutting a bit of the public sector, which Hollande is going to row back. But between them, they both agreed that the deficit had to be cut because France is, of course, hugely in debt. So it was more a vote about what is to come in France than what has already gone before us, unlike in Greece. So France hasn't yet been very, very badly suffering from austerity, but the fact is that Hollande is now going to have to deliver some very unpalatable truths. So while he is on the European level being this austerity buster, at home there's no doubt he's going to start, you know, attacking the deficit very, very soon.
Just specifically in terms of the European angle, is he, you know, he sort of said he'd renegotiate the pact, and then just a day or two before the election it became something a bit softer than renegotiate, didn't it? I mean, what mood music since the election? Is he talking tough to Angela or not?
Well, I mean, nothing is coming out of his camp before he takes power on May the 15th. But his position is this. I think what you're going to find is something being added to the austerity pact rather than taken away. So we're going to have this added level of growth measures, which he wants. Now, there are a lot of other governments, not necessarily on the left, that agree with this. For example, in the Netherlands and in Spain as well, that, you know, one size fits all austerity doesn't work anymore. So what Hollande is going to try and do is add on a sort of growth decision, growth measures to that, which could be things like tapping funds from the European Central Bank, which is going to be difficult with Germany. But there are other things which Germany, I think, is prepared to look at, like the role of a European Investment Bank, for example, and the EU budget underwriting things like green technology, all this idea of putting a bit more money in to keep the economy afloat and to basically bring back growth. And I think you'll find that he gets on quite well with Merkel, actually. They're both sort of centrist pragmatists. And I think, you know, as Hollande's top man said last week, there will be some kind of compromise. I think compromise is the key word.
Well, if compromise is the order of the day in Paris still, it doesn't seem to be a feature in Greece, does it? I mean, because this is Politics Weekly, I get the chance to say, now, Greece's electoral system is really something quite special. They, first of all, engineer it to make it fair by having a proportional representation system, and then they double engineer it to make sure there's a clear outcome by giving 50 extra seats to the party who gets the most votes. But even with all this double engineering, Adich, they've not produced a winner this week.
You said at the start of the programme that Greece is now sort of in chaos because of the elections. I'd say Greece has been in chaos pretty much since the summer of 2010. In 2009, it admitted, just before Christmas 2009, it admitted it had a huge problem with its public finances. The result of that was in summer 2010, Greece was forced to sign up to a huge austerity package, which went down with ordinary Greeks like a lead balloon. And ever since then, you've just seen general strikes, marches on Parliament, a complete loss of legitimacy amongst MPs. This is before the election. And I think what the elections show you, what last weekend's election show you, is a complete cratering of the mainstream that wanted to keep Greece within the euro. Because within Greece, within kind of popular debate in Greece now, the euro is essentially seen as kind of a cipher for imposing austerity. So it's two things. It's both economic hard times, but it's also a loss of political sovereignty. And if you look at the parties which have profited out of that, the far right, nasty people like Golden Dawn, which are essentially a Nazi party, and the far left, what you get is people who are either opposed to austerity or opposed to the euro full stop.
And do you think that it's Syriza, is it, the left-wing coalition that's currently trying and almost certainly going to fail to put together a coalition? Could you imagine it putting together a coalition that wanted to stay in the euro, or would it have to be an out-of-the-euro coalition?
Syriza is a really odd concoction because it's got Trotskyites in there, as well as people who left the mainstream PASOK socialist party that was in power until the weekend. Syriza is actually having negotiations with the head of the PASOK party, Venizelos. And Venizelos is the finance minister who actually pushed through the austerity measures. So I think that tells you about the level of confusion that there is in Greece at the moment. The key kind of implication out of all of that in Greece for the rest of Europe is this. Next month, Europe is meant to hand over another tranche of loan money, what's called a bailout, but it's actually just a big loan to Greece. It can't do that without a government in place, and it certainly can't do that if it's got a government in place that just rejects the austerity measures. So what happens then? How Greece goes about paying wages for civil servants, teachers, keeps hospitals going, all the rest of it, becomes a really live question.
So, Martin, we've heard a lot about the travails of governments that have decided to try and pay back overdrafts, if you like, to use a controversial metaphor. It's always easier in politics to stand on a platform of racking up the overdraft in the first place, but you know, austerity doesn't seem to be working, but covering up the busted balance sheets like they did in Greece before, it didn't work either. I mean, how can democracy respond?
Well, this all goes back to another Greek, doesn't it? If you go back to Plato, he says, you know, that in the end, what the people want isn't always what is good for the state. And, I mean, you've got a kind of classic example of that arguably happening in Greece at the moment. I think in each of these cases, national histories and factors play in very important respects. And, you know, we shouldn't forget that, you know, Greece shouldn't really have joined the euro in the first place. It was able to do so because the rules were set and in a way which allowed them to finesse that. Greek politics is obviously affected still by the legacy of the civil war after the Second World War and by the legacy of the military rule of the colonels in the 60s and 70s. And all Greek political parties reflect that to some that history to some degree, and that's not something which we or other countries share in precisely the same way. So, you know, it's a very special political situation, and as you say, the parties have all tanked there. I understand that the failure of each of the parties to form a government, which does look likely now, will lead to a second general election as soon as next month. Now, if that happens, that really is an election which, in effect, is a referendum on Greek membership of the euro. Now, if that if the effect of that is to make Greek participation within the euro impossible, then I think that is the moment that this crisis has been heading towards for the last 2 to 3 years, as Aditya was saying. And of course, that's huge for Greece above all, but it's huge for the Eurozone as well.
I think that's that historical context is fantastically important. I mean, you notice over the last couple of years that the trajectory of this crisis has been from for the unthinkable to rapidly become thought and then to become quite a normal part of the conversation. So it wasn't that long ago that simply discussing a country leaving the single currency the way we are now was just absolutely off the agenda. And no one, certainly in Brussels, would even brook that as part of the conversation. And then you sort of zoom out to that historical context that Martin was talking about. More widely, there aren't that many countries in Europe where it is culturally that acceptable to have ease of great brutal austerity packages, real suffering, people losing their jobs, inflicted in such a way as can be presented by populists as being done at Germany's behest.
That's only Ireland that seems kind of weirdly mellow with it all.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, and that is, I think, again, an exception and quite extraordinary for that very reason. And certainly my impression of it is that you have there's a rising anxiety, certainly at the sort of elite political level, that we have been very complacent about the political stability of Western Europe for a generation. That it is, to not want it to sound too grandiose, but the normal state of European history is turmoil and violence. And in the second half of the 20th century, there was a fantastic bit, certainly in the Western half of the continent, of things going rather swimmingly. And as you said, in Greece, but in a lot of Southern Europe, how far do we want to test how stable democracy is when, as in Spain, you have more than 50% of young people unemployed?
I just wonder, when I hear this talk about democracy in the economy, there is another aspect of this which is removed from both of those, which is about the banking sector. If you were to look at the example of Spain, which I think is hugely important in this respect, Spain kicked out its centre-left Prime Minister Zapatero, who went ahead and did basically what he was told to do by Northern Europe and imposed a mild austerity programme. They have a centre-right guy called Rajoy. Rajoy has announced yesterday that he's going to part-nationalise one of the biggest banks in Spain, Bankia. And come the end of this week, they will do another round of part nationalisations. That's what it sounds like. So it will effectively be like having Gordon Brown and Alistair Darling circa 2008. This is arguably something that should have happened across Europe back in 2008. And part of the reason why I think austerity's failed, the markets aren't buying austerity, people aren't willing to put up austerity, is because plainly the bill of reckoning has not been paid by one sector within the economy, and that's banks. Banks have avoided the kind of constraints of austerity. Banks have avoided being part nationalised. Banks have avoided fessing up even to the amount of bad loans on their books. In that context, one of the things that I think you have to give the Greeks and the Spanish and the Italians even some credit for is for them saying, hang on, why is it that we're paying back all of this? Why is it we're the ones who are having to slough all this off when the banks effectively shucked off their responsibility for this? And I think that's right. And I think also, if you talk to people in financial markets, you can give them as much austerity as you like, but they won't buy it because they can look at the banking sector and they say the banking sector across Southern Europe, and indeed across tracts of Northern Europe too, is just rotten. Until that is sorted out, we're not going near this.
Angelique, it was the financiers, the money men, sort of were the enemy in the background, weren't they, with the campaign you've just been through in Paris?
Yeah, it was interesting. Hollande said that his only adversary was the world of finance. And there was a little clause behind that, which we're now all looking at very closely, which is faceless finance. So basically what he is against is and what he's really spelling out now, is this faceless kind of mad, what he calls mad speculation. He's not against, however, finance in general in terms of what he would call good finance, you know, helping the economy. So I think we're not going to find him cracking down on anyone who's making any money. But there are some key measures which are going to come in the next few months, which are going to have an impact. One of them is, of course, he wants to cut the fat cat salaries of the chief executives of state companies, which the state has a stake in, of course, for big utility companies in terms of electricity and so on. That's going to be an interesting question for chief executives and whether it's going to bounce back off the private sector. He's then having a 75% tax on income over 1 million euros. And so there has been an idea with rich people flee France. At the moment, it doesn't seem to be the case, although we do keep getting sort of property advisors talking about whether people are moving to Belgium or London. So he's quite interesting. He's very cautious. You know, he used to be a state auditor. He taught economics. He's not a kind of brash, hard left person at all. And there are, you know, several bankers on the left that say, you know, desperate times call for desperate measures. And Hollande is very much in the sense that the wealthiest people must pay their share. So not just these mad fat cat salaries, which isn't going to affect that many people in France, a 75% tax, but on the lower level below that, he's increasing tax on higher salaries anyway, because he says they have to pay more into the reconstruction effort.
That's another example of how each situation is a bit different. I mean, because France does have this rather strange feature, which, you know, we don't have here, which is a tradition of progressive bankers.
Yes, I almost picked you up and said, did you say the right thing there when you said bankers on the left? But yeah, I mean, go on, Martin.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, we don't think of that as being part of the political equation that we're used to. You know, I mean, since the destruction of all the mutuals, which were a kind of UK equivalent, there is, you know, there hasn't been anything like that, you know, within
the building societies.
Yeah, all that. But you know, France, you know, France is a different culture too, and so it has this strong republican sense, even in some of its financial institutions, which are much more mercantilist and state oriented than they are here, for example. So, you know, again, you're not dealing absolutely with the, you know, the same template in each country. Each country reflects through its own traditions as well as the problems of the shared fiscal crisis.
I mean, that sounds absolutely right. And as soon as we start talking about Athens or Dublin or Paris, you know, we do see these differences, Aditya. But can you just explain for us a bit about the contagion question? Because they might all be different, but they're all part of a same system. If Athens is on the way out, still a bit of an if, but becoming less of an if by the day, how quickly and, well, will that spread to other European capitals, and how quickly?
Yeah, the key comparison I think you could easily draw in here is Britain. Britain is more financialized than any other European country, and Britain effectively just came a cropper really badly in 2008 when the world banking system went down. But what it could do was it could obviously devalue its currency, which is effectively what happened over the past couple of years. So the pound lost 25% of its value, and it could unilaterally drop down its interest rates. What happened in Eurozone is that if you're in Greece, you need the same measures, but you can't do it because monetary policy is set out of Frankfurt. And the same thing applies if Greece wants to drop out of the Eurozone, or if Greece is going to be forced out of the Eurozone, is that Greece is actually a tiny, tiny country. It's worth 3% of European GDP. And yet, as soon as Greece goes anywhere near the exit, questions then are raised about, well, who will follow it? So will Portugal go as well? Will Spain possibly go? You know, what about Italy? Ireland, I think you were right, Tom. Ireland's signed up to austerity, and Ireland's signed up to membership of the euro, and there doesn't seem to be any question marks.
Although presumably that could change if it starts to look optional.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is that you have countries of wavering enthusiasm for the euro signed into the Euro Pact, and there is no exit mechanism. There is no exit strategy. So how is it that, you know, what do you do if, for instance, you wake up in Athens tomorrow and they've come out of the euro and they're now on drachmas? How does that effectively work? what will happen if you go to the cash machine? How are you going to get your salary? What will happen if you want to take your salary and you actually want to take it down to shops? Will any shopkeeper accept it?
And, well, and presumably also there's a massive problem about your euro-denominated debt that then spreads through every single other European financial centre.
One of the really interesting things is that you've seen big companies like Siemens have now started writing to their own contracts that they will accept euros and only euros when it comes to the Greeks. So they are reaffirming the fact that they won't accept any possible national currency, any national rival.
OK, let's say thanks to Angelique at that point and move to Britain, which is, as Aditya says, yet another country, although it's here back at home, where the government is also finding that austerity is not especially popular, whether euro-denominated or not. It's reeling from a thumping at the polls after the local elections, and with those results still ringing in their ears, ministers this week relaunched the coalition's principles gloriously at a tractor factory in Basildon, which was followed by a Queen's speech which was going to make life better for families. How do you think they did this week, Martin? Was it, I mean, relaunch is always an awkward thing to do in politics because as soon as you need one, people kind of are sort of sneering at you. But do you think they got on the front foot?
I don't. No, I think it's... It continues to be very difficult for the coalition, and that's partly because it's a coalition and the tensions within the coalition are much more overt and disruptive than they were 2 years ago when there certainly was a kind of sense of a common purpose. Now that's the common purpose is to avoid destruction rather than to achieve some grander liberal conservative vision of the sort that we heard a bit about
and you think
2 years ago. But I think, you know, in the short term, I think the Queen's speech was a rather kind of muddled exercise, and I think the problem is that rather too rapidly for, you know, its own satisfaction, the government has really retreated into a position where everything hinges on the economy and nothing much matters at all. You know, all the eggs are in a rather rickety basket. And I think, and you know, that is not a good position to be in with 3 years to go. It may turn out okay. You know, if you look far enough down in the polling, which is basically very bad for the coalition, you eventually get to a question in a lot of YouGov polling, which says, if you had to choose between a Conservative government led by David Cameron and a Labour government led by Ed Miliband, which would you choose? People choose the Conservative government led by David Cameron. But until you get down to that stark choice, people just... that this government is very unpopular all of a sudden, and they have not been able to cope with a counter move yet, and I don't think the relaunch really worked at all.
I think that's a crucial distinction. That, I mean, the local elections were obviously very bad for the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats, but the essence of a midterm poll like that, the question you're asking, apart from local issues, is do you like the government? To which the answer generally tends to be no. That's a very different question to... would you like to exchange this government for the other one that you see on the opposition benches? And we don't know what the answer to that question is yet. I think that the relaunch, or the event that they had, as you referred to in the tractor factory, was very revealing, because actually it got a terrible response, which I think expresses quite a lot about the sort of social norms that are going on in the media, the way we look at this. Because actually it was a perfectly competent performance by two pretty smooth politicians standing up doing their thing that they always do. Now, why did it fall so flat? Well, partly because what was remarkable about that famous Rose Garden press conference in the spring of 2010 isn't what they said, but the chemistry, the bonhomie that existed between them. And that's what gave the impression that, wow, this is something transformational happening in politics, which then was sort of wrapped up this sense that we are coming together in the national interest to solve an economic emergency. Now, what you have now is the economic emergency plainly unsolved. So you add that, you take away the personal chemistry between them, which has been poisoned by all sorts of rows.
And you think it's personal, do you? I mean, just because it's not just that they've both got to represent their bases and their bases now hate each other. You think...
The bases definitely hate each other.
The parliamentary, ministerial level, they hate each other.
Yeah, I think they're certainly... I think that the hatred flows from the bottom and upwards, and that is partly because... And then it's a massive problem for the government, because it means that there aren't enough foot soldiers out there who can take ownership of the government's programme and defend it on the doorstep. And what you saw happening on the elections was abstention by key activists, people who really you need to go out and fight for you. But I think also the budget is absolutely vital in this, has poisoned coalition relations right up to quad level almost. And although there's a determination to make it function at the top, the sort of cozy chumminess, my understanding, is completely gone.
Blimey. Martin used a very interesting word when he talked about the Queen's speech. He used the word muddle. And when the coalition first came in, this sense of muddling through was often used in quite a positive sense. Members of political commentariat, and I agree with Raf here, I think the political commentariat were perhaps a bit too overexcited about the very formation of a coalition, too willing to sit back in wonder. But the very sense of muddling through was seen as a positive thing for about a year and a half. But there's one problem with that, which I think takes you back to the Eurozone problem too, which is you can muddle through and you can claim that you're being pragmatic until it becomes clear that it's not working. Mm. In the case of Greece, obviously, you have an economy which has shrunk by 20% in less than 5 years. In the case of Britain too, we're still smaller as an economy than we were in 2008. And you combine that with, I think Raf's right, when it comes to the budget, a clear sense that there was a sense of priorities here, and the priorities were to give a cut in the top rate of taxes to the super rich and not to give very much back to people at the bottom, which may not be true. I actually think there's more of a case the coalition could make, especially for middle earners than for some people at the bottom. But you get that sense of incompetence and you get that sense of unfairness. And I think that does away all the sense of the positive aspects of muddling through.
And crucially, sorry, just to finish that point about the budget, I think I wanted to try and over psychoanalyze what happens in cabinet ministers, but I think there is a strong sense at which there was a bad political judgment was made in terms of cutting the 50p tax. The Liberal Democrats sort of warned that that might be the case. Their presentation of it was appalling. That falls at the feet of George Osborne. That is his responsibility, and to an extent, David Cameron. And what is now happening, I think, is a lot of blaming of the Lib Dems, because it's much easier to think our stupid coalition partners, they're really stopping us from being an effective government at the top and at the bottom of the Conservative Party, rather than basically looking at themselves and saying, we're not as good at doing this as we thought we would be.
Martin, this week, Matthew Paris in The Times wrote a column, and he was arguing that actually David Cameron is a muddle through sort of guy, and he could kind of make a virtue of that. And as Aditya is saying, that's getting harder to do. But it does look, when you look at the coalition's attempt at these big picture, almost Brownite kind of set piece events, by which I mean the budget or the Queen's speech, they're really not very good at those anymore. Would they be better just doing away with them and making their announcements one at a time?
Well, I don't think Gordon Brown's a very good model. I also think that George Osborne, curiously, just as Raf's been indicating, I think George Osborne has actually been exposed as a bit of a Gordon Brown playbook reader. This budget was the kind of budget that Gordon Brown used to always do, these kind of tricksy things which you only got to understand once you looked in the detail. It was all too clever by half. And I think Osborne did have, and I confess I bought into this a bit, that his political sense was very acute, and that he had a good sense of direction for the Tory party electorally, and his antennae were good, because that was certainly the case up to the 2010 election. But I think he's fumbled the ball very often at the Treasury, and I think he's very damaged by this. And the question, in rather sort of crude personal terms, at the moment seems to me to be whether Cameron can get him, whether Cameron has got another gear to get the Tory part of this coalition back into credibility.
And by moving Osborne, is that what you're getting at?
Well, I don't think he's going to do that. He's not going to do that. He doesn't really want to shuffle anybody very much. But I think he is going to have to sort of face up to some of these things a bit at some point. He is at some point in the next year or so going to have to exercise leadership in a way which reflects well on the government, which proves to work for the government. Now, that may be just that he happens to be sitting there when things start going better in the economy. That would probably do it for him, I think. That'd be very good news if that was to happen. But we don't see that happening. I think the psychological effect of going back into recession is very damaging for the Tory party at the moment. So, at the moment, I await you know, the next chapter of the Cameron story a lot hangs on how he plays it.
I think one of the most dangerous things for Cameron at the moment is that as he becomes sort of wedded, he's put so much of his political capital in coalition, you get a debate going on in the Conservative Party about what the future of the party should be that looks beyond Cameronism and looks beyond Osborne. It's like, well, you've taken us halfway there, you got us to a coalition, but actually the whole conversation about what should 21st century conservatism be, what will be the project that will give us the kind of hegemony that Margaret Thatcher used to have, they're not looking to Cameron to deliver that for them anymore. And even the sort of 2010 intake of MPs, young Conservatives, they're looking elsewhere.
I think actually just to move away from that sort of rather grand vision thing, the thing that really struck me in relation to the Queen's speech was that this was the first series of economic policy announcements from the government for which there was no commendation from any major business group. That's the first time I remember seeing that happen in 2 years, that the CBI, the IOD, all the rest of them, none of them came out and said, we welcome the economic policy announcements in the Queen's speech, which, considering the way that they backed austerity, the way they backed even the cutting the 50p tax, tells you that I think the business group may be starting to come loose from the Tory party. And if you were Chukra Munna and Ed Miliband, you might be watching with interest.
The confidence fairy is dead.
Oh dear, on that terribly grim note, we're going to draw things to a close for this week. My thanks to Angelique Chrysophis in Paris, as well as to Aditya Chakraborty, Martin Kettle and Raphael Baer here in London. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark. Come back next week when we'll be catching up with Leveson, where the man not in the dock, I don't know what the right phrase is, but is Andy Coulson today and Rebecca Brooks tomorrow. And so we look forward to that, and thanks for listening in the meantime.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a 1 month, no commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.